The Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Center of Western North Carolina would like to welcome you to this episode of our podcast, brought to you by BehaviorTherapist.com. Each episode presents news and interviews pertaining to the cognitive behavioral therapies and evidence-based psychotherapy, containing content relevant to consumers and professionals alike. In this episode, Dr. Jody Palaha on remedies for parents to address common childhood sleeping problems. For more information about upcoming or previous episodes, please visit BehaviorTherapist.com. Dr. Jody Palaha is a licensed pediatric psychologist and assistant professor of psychology at East Tennessee State University. She has over 10 years' experience working in pediatric primary care settings where, by some reports, concerns about development and behavior are more common than ear infections, with top concerns including behavior problems, toilet seat, and sleeping. In addition to her clinical background, Dr. Palaha published over 20 research articles and book chapters relating to childhood behaviors. Dr. Palaha, thank you for your time today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So we know that parents generally know that less sleep for them and for their child's a problem, but what specifically is the impact of less sleep on children?
We actually have been finding out more and more about problems that come up with sleep, and one of the things that has sort of been surprising is the idea that we had thought that problems during early childhood were sort of transient, and we know that about 25% of kids have these kind of brief periods of difficulty with sleep. Turns out that a lot of those can develop into kind of long-term sleep problems that really give kids difficulties even across the lifespan.
Interesting. And what kinds of difficulties are we talking about?
Specifically, problems with mood, kind of regulating mood. Kids who don't sleep well are more subject to being kind of emotionally variable, more upset, more depressed, kind of having mood swings, tantrums, all those kinds of difficulties throughout the day. And it's always kind of a nice side benefit of working with these kids who have difficulty with sleep, hearing about how much better they perform behaviorally through the day after they do start getting more and more sleep. So mood is probably the biggest area, mood and behavior. Even academic performance, school performance, thinking and cognitive skills and development are affected by not getting enough sleep, and that's an area that's emerging. We're getting more and more information on how much sleep decrement can affect thinking and learning.
So that leads to my wondering, how much sleep should children be getting, and does that differ by age of the child? I guess we should sort of specify, are we talking about babies, toddlers, school-age children, and what sort of sleep requirements do they have?
Well, you know, I think if parents are listening, and the thing to just remember is that most kids aren't getting enough sleep. I think people underestimate, in general, how much sleep kids need. Infants need something like 16 and a half, 17 hours of sleep throughout the day and night, about evenly divided between daytime and nighttime sleep, so 8 or 9 hours at night, and then just about 6 to 8 during the day. When you get up to two-year-olds, for example, that's a good example, you're still looking at 10 to 11 hours of sleep at night and a two-hour nap during the day. That's still a lot of sleep, 12, 13 hours of sleep daily. When you get to four-year-olds and five-year-olds, a lot of people are getting to where their child is dropping the nap, which is appropriate. By four, there really isn't a daytime sleep requirement. You're looking at still 11 to 11 and a half hours of nighttime sleep for four- and five-year-olds. So just to put that in tangible terms, you know, if you have a four- or five-year-old, you should really be looking at sleep times that go from, say, 8 o'clock at night until 7 o'clock in the morning. That would be a reasonable length of time for the average four or five-year-old to sleep. It really doesn't go down by much, like a half hour or even 15 minutes per year from the five-year-old age on. And even when you get to like 14 and 15 years, you're still looking at 9, 8 and a half maybe hours of sleep at night. So you're really getting closer to maybe what adults need at that point in time.
Wow, I bet that is much more than most of us would expect, certainly more than I expected that a child would need.
Just a little editorial comment on that is that I am always interested to meet parents who have really high expectations for their child's well-being and really concerned about what school they're going to send their child to and looking up school ratings and how high and how well school in their neighborhood or whatever is performing, who are very concerned about nutrition and don't like to feed lots of sweets and get concerned about how many hot dogs their child has had, that sort of thing. And on a variety of dimensions, they're clearly very much concerned about making sure they act in their child's best interest. But people really do underestimate the sleep issue. And so those same people have their kids up late at night and not sleeping in late enough in the morning to really kind of meet the need that those kids have. It's not really an issue for your child to stay up late at night, as long as, you know, you're in a position where they can sleep in just as late as they need to in the morning to get the total number of hours that they should be getting. And, you know, the impact of, you know, that sleep decrement is really substantial. It's very measurable, and it's just as significant as not eating healthy food or, you know, not going to a good school.
That's interesting. Do you have any speculation why there's this tendency, at least anecdotally, to not put that on the same level as diet and so forth?
Well, my speculation is twofold. I think one is that we're just a really busy society anymore, and we keep kids real busy, and we don't want to turn down busyness. And so I noticed even with my four-year-old, there's, you know, gymnastics, and there's soccer, and there's t-ball, and a lot of these things are at 5:30 or 6 in the evening. And if you go to a 6 p.m. t-ball match and you play until 7, you don't get home till 7:30. By the time you wind down and take a bath and brush your teeth and, who knows, maybe even eat dinner, it's going to be 9 o'clock before you can get in the bed. You know, most kids are up and out the door in the morning. They go to preschool or daycare or someplace that they have to be up by 7. So you've just lost an hour right there. And that's if you're really meticulous about getting your kid to bed right as quick as you can after a t-ball match. I think the other issue is that it really takes a lot of commitment to be vigilant about getting kids to bed on time. It's harder, I think, in many ways than looking into what school they should go to or taking them to all the best birthday parties or even manipulating diet, I think, because you have to be on top of your game. You have to stick to the schedule. You have to be the one to turn off the TV at 6:30 when you know there's going to be a fight about it, and stick to your rules and stick to your structure, and even for yourself. I mean, I know with my kids, we're out someplace, we're having a really good time. I'm looking at my watch thinking, geez, it's already 7 o'clock. You know, I really like to have my four-year-old in bed by 8. We need to leave now. We're all having fun. It's hard to decide and be consistent about that.
So now we know why it's important for them to have sleep. Let's assume for a minute that it's, and you've just sort of alluded to this in the last little bit here, that it's hard to get your kids to sleep, either initially or, you know, they're waking up during the night. What are some of the common problems that parents might deal with in that regard?
That's a good next question, because I think some of the bedtime problems that are most common probably affect some of why parents go ahead and delay putting their kids to bed early enough. And that's because the number one problem is bedtime resistance, and that's a top concern among all concerns of all behavior, development, and emotional well-being among children. I think if you look at the top three concerns, it's sleeping, toileting, and just general disruptive behavior. But sleep is a huge one, and bedtime resistance is the top of sleep. And that is really just kids that just really resist going to bed. This isn't anything too surprising when you think about it. Laying in bed in the dark is about the most boring thing a kid could think of doing. People talk about using timeout as a discipline strategy. Putting someone to bed is basically using a timeout when no bad behavior has occurred, putting your kid in a timeout. And kids really resist that. They don't like it. So that's the number one problem that we see with bedtime or with sleep with kids. A similar kind of connected problem sometimes occurs, sometimes occurs by itself, is kids who are very much sort of cue dependent to fall asleep. So they're not resistant to bedtime, but they have to have a particular regimen or a particular setting or a particular object or something with them when they go to bed, and it makes them very high maintenance sleepers. Those kids also typically have problems with frequent nighttime awakening. We can talk more about why that is and how to solve that problem. So like night awakening is another big issue that we see with kids. And I think after we talk about those two things, kind of resistance, kind of high maintenance sleepers, frequent nighttime awakenings, the only other thing I'd mention that comes up some is sleep terrors, which is a distinct problem, and that's kids who wake up shortly after they've gone to bed, maybe a couple hours into the night, really screaming and crying and carrying on as though they've had a nightmare, except that they really don't seem completely awake. They're hard to kind of settle, and they don't remember any specific content to their dream. So those are the top concerns that we see.
And I'm wondering, would it be okay to go down some of these concerns and maybe discuss some strategies that parents can use to deal with them?
Absolutely. So bedtime resistance is the number one, and what you have is kids who make a lot of curtain calls. And if you're a parent that deals with this, then you know what I'm talking about. This is a lot of the one more drink of water, one more kiss, one more story, one more hug, and then a lot of things like I can't sleep because this and that. And you think they're sleeping, and then they come downstairs one more time, and there's something else going on with those kids. Those are really those kinds of problems are really a struggle. And I think the solution for bedtime resistance is very similar to the solution for some of the other problems. I'm going to just mention the other problems, which is just frequent nighttime awakenings or kids who have a very sort of specific setting or situation where they have to fall asleep. They maybe need to lay in mom's bed, or they maybe need to have television on, or they maybe need to have a certain song. I've met kids who needed to have their parents gently stroke their arm with a paintbrush while they were falling asleep, and that's the only way that they could transition to sleep. What's going on for a lot of these kids, whether it's bedtime resistance or some kind of specific ritual that kids need, is that they really have not associated the bed with falling asleep. And we call this kind of a stimulus control problem. The bed is not associated with sleep. It's associated with resisting sleep, asking for more drinks, getting up, fooling around, tossing and turning, jumping up and down, calling out for mom, maybe even being non-compliant or throwing tantrums, or for some kids, being afraid, being anxious, being worried comes up. The bed symbolizes all those behaviors. Or the bed is associated with sleep, but only in the presence of mom laying down with me or somebody stroking my ear or somebody singing a certain lullaby. And that's what makes bed really difficult. And in order to get a child to be a successful sleeper, we have to kind of simplify what they need. Ideally, the bed by itself in a dark room with a cooler temperature and no additional noises or stimulation should be the stimulus that's associated with sleep. And so we call that kind of good sleep hygiene, and that's what parents want to strive for. Not having a television on, not having lights on, not having a music box playing, not having a person in there. It's hard to get to that, so some suggestions I typically recommend. First of all, most parents, when their kids aren't falling asleep well, they know their child isn't getting enough sleep. Their temptation is to move the bedtime earlier in the night. So they're not getting to bed at time. They need more sleep. Usually put them down at 9. We're going to make you go to bed at 8 because you really have trouble with this and you really need your sleep. In fact, the best strategy is to actually go the other way. If they're typically laying down at 9, you're trying to get them down at 9, but they're not falling asleep till 10 or 11, then you need to push the bedtime back. And I would push it back to where they usually do fall asleep, not when you lay them down, but when they actually fall asleep. So if you're having a struggle that's lasting a couple of hours, then push it back to 11 o'clock. And that seems crazy to put an 8-year-old to bed at 11 o'clock or 11:30 at night, but that's really where you have to start, is to put them to bed when they're good and tired, because you want them to be good and tired and lay down and fall asleep. You also need to establish a wake time that's consistent, and that means even on the weekends. So we're going to get you up at 7, regardless of what day of the week it is. If you're going down at 11, you're waking up at 7, it's only 8 hours of sleep. Probably not enough for the child that you're working with, but that's where you have to start. So you have this established sleep window, we call it, and you stick with that sleep window. And the first night, you still have some resistance, or you might still have a child that's dependent upon these cues and really wants you to play the television or really wants you to lay there with them, and you don't do that. And I can give you a couple of other strategies for that in just a minute. The idea is that you present just the things you want them to associate with sleep, a nice comfy bed in a dark room, and maybe a transitional object like a favorite doll or stuffed animal or something like that, blanket. And it maybe not doesn't go very well the first night. It still may take them an hour or two to settle and fall asleep, but then they really have been without sleep. Now it's only been 6 hours of sleep. So the next night when you go to bed at 11 o'clock, they're even more tired. And usually by the third or fourth night, you have kids transitioning to sleep pretty quickly in the presence of those kind of cues I just mentioned, quiet, dark room. And if you kind of repeat that for several nights, you kind of have established a new set of cues for sleep that really are where you want to be. And now you can start backing the bedtime up in small increments. I usually go with 15 to 30 minute increments every few nights until they gradually get back to to the 8 o'clock bedtime or whatever it is that you were striving to get with in the beginning. Now, one additional thing I'll mention is that if you have a child that is cue dependent and needs you to lay there, or even a child that's resistant, you might try to use kind of a sort of graduated presence sort of program where you agree to be in the room next to the bed, perhaps sitting on a chair by the bed, even stroking their hair or periodically touching their back, maybe singing lullabies quietly. You do that initially, and then you say, I'll be right back. And you step out of the room, and you just step out for a few seconds and come right back in and begin again for 10, 20, 30 seconds, and then I'll be right back, and you step out. And you graduate by adding more and more time to the stepping out part. So as time goes by, you're stepping out for 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, etc., longer and longer intervals, and typically kids then in that interval have time to fall asleep. And if the child is complaining or whining or crying or doing anything that's not sleep compatible, then you know, I typically will recommend that parents leave the room and wait until they're quiet before they come back in and start again. And then start with the smallest interval and gradually work your way back up again. So that kind of graduated attention condition sort of program combined with a sleep window are really the best two strategies. And not, it never hurts to add a morning reward for staying in your bed all night, or a morning reward for, you know, doing your best to fall asleep, or whatever works for your child or is appropriate for what's been going on with your family. Pick a favorite cereal or get to watch cartoons before school type rewards for some kids.
Fantastic. And just to clarify, so within the strategies you just mentioned, if you have a child who's really throwing a tantrum, say a really long, drawn-out one, a heavy one, is the recommendation to just stay out of the room regardless of how long that goes on?
There's two ways to go. I'm glad you asked that. We really recommend two kind of different strategies. One is called cold turkey, which is where you literally do just stay out of the room throughout the entire tantrum and until they fall asleep. You just don't provide any intermediate attention. Most parents do not feel like they're going to be successful with that strategy. And it's actually a very dangerous strategy to try unless you know that you can do it. Because if you go out to the hall and your intention is to ignore the whole tantrum, and the tantrum escalates and escalates and escalates to the point where you feel like you can't ignore it anymore, perhaps you now hear objects flying or something, and you go in there and attend that behavior, you have just taught your child a really worse behavior. And so now you're probably going to have more throwing and more problematic behavior. So you have to be able to ignore through all that behavior. Eventually it stops. The child settles down and goes to sleep, and they learn that none of that behavior is going to be effective. The only thing that works is for me just to go to sleep and wait till morning. I haven't met very many parents who feel confident to wait that one out. So there's that option. And then the other option is what I mentioned, where you kind of come in every so often on a graduated basis, providing attention. And you do that regardless of whether they're laying perfectly quiet. Now, they need to be in the bed. And if they're not in the bed, you just kind of matter-of-factly guide them back into the bed, and then you kind of go back to your graduated attention, kind of leaving and coming back on intervals. And you do that even if they're laying there crying and fussing. That's kind of the other extreme. So one's cold turkey and one a little more attention and being present. The hybrid option is just, you know, if you're out of the bed or if you're really carrying on, I'm going to wait in the hall. As soon as you're in bed and you're trying to settle down, or you're settled down, or you're quiet, or doing something that is compatible with sleep, then I'll come in. That's kind of my favorite. And then, you know, as long as you're continuing that behavior, I'll continue to come in on the graduated schedule that I mentioned earlier.
And are there any different considerations that parents of an infant should have? Or is the logic the same?
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that. Infants are so challenging because, of course, parents are so tired when trying to make decisions about, should I let him cry it out, or should I pick him up? And it makes just the whole decision-making process that much more interesting. And infants are obviously have very different needs. They're hungry more frequently and eat on different schedules and do all kinds of things. And they also are rapidly developing their sleep needs, and their sort of kind of wake-sleep schedule is really chaotic and hard to keep up with. Just when you think you know what they're going to do next, they do something different. I have just from my own experience with two children and talking with lots of parents, all sort of started with the advice of don't worry about too much for 3 months. During the first 3 months of life, I mean, babies are just so new and developing and tiny and needing of nutrition and all kinds of things that there's just really not much that you can do special that will promote good sleep or set a schedule for your child. And you'll hear parents sometimes say their 3-year-old is on, or 3-month-old is on the schedule, and they're just really lucky, I guess. I don't think that happens very often. So I think, you know, kind of the don't stress too much during the first few months recommendation is my first point. And then I guess after that, even in those first 3 months, whenever it's possible, and certainly after the first 3 months, as much as possible, the key advice is to lay them in the bed while they're drowsy but awake. Don't let them drift to sleep in your arms or in a sling or a backpack or a front pack or any of those things too often if you want them to be skilled at sleeping in their bed. I don't have a problem with them sleeping in arms and backpacks and all those sorts of things from time to time. My kids did that. But to the extent that they're sleeping outside of the bed a lot, they will have more difficulty sleeping in the bed. And then, of course, holding them until they're asleep and then expecting to lay them down in the bed creates a bunch of problems. For one, it typically wakes them up when you move them, or can. But number two, the bigger problem is that if they get comfortable with sleeping in your arms and your arms become the stimuli that they're most familiar with in transitioning to sleep, then they will need those arms every time they cycle out of sleep. And that creates a real problem for infants because they cycle out of sleep frequently. So they're laying in their beds and sleeping. They go into some deeper stages of sleep. They come out of those deeper stages and get into some lighter sleep, and they suddenly realize, oh, I'm in the bed. I'm not in her arms. And they jars them awake, and they need the arms again to transition back. A healthy sleeper will just kind of realize that they're still in the bed, that's where they fell asleep, that's where they always sleep, and they'll just kind of drift back into sleep, and they'll sleep for a longer period of time and get more quality sleep. So putting them into sleep, into the bed while drowsy but still awake is really a critical recommendation for young infants and even toddlers. And then I guess the last thing I found helpful, and I don't know that this is too evidence-based, but it makes sense conceptually, is to sort of loosely structure their day, particularly after 3 months, with a sleep, eat, wake cycle. So they sleep, they wake up and eat, then they have some active play, wake time, and then they go to sleep. I think frequently people do a sleep, wake, eat cycle where they're eating just before they go to sleep. And what some kids will do is get tired, not eat very well, but also eat and fall asleep while having the bottle, and then become dependent upon the bottle or breast to fall asleep. So that stimulus becomes the only way that they can transition to sleep, and now you have sort of the same kinds of problems I was mentioning earlier.
Great advice. All of this advice you've said today is going to be very helpful to parents, but I wonder if some parents find themselves in a position where they're not able to get these sleep problems under control, should they seek professional help? And if so, how would they know when that time is, and where might they go to find help?
You know, I think if you try some of these strategies, and, you know, within a few weeks, these strategies are fast acting, not necessarily for infants, nothing fast acting for infants. They're just really, they take some time. But particularly with kids, you know, 18 months and older, if you're trying to get a sleep schedule figured out, get them sleeping better, and you're doing some of the things we talked about in our conversation today, and you're not seeing improvements in 2 to 3 weeks, then it's, you know, if you're concerned about your child getting less sleep than needed, and you can see, even if you can see that they're not getting good, having good behavior during the day, that's affecting their ability to function, certainly it'll be affecting your ability to function, and this is a consistent pattern. It's happening every night, and it's been going on, or at least close to every night, and it's been going on for some months, then I would definitely seek some help. Sometimes physicians can be helpful. A child's pediatrician can be helpful. If not with specific recommendations, then maybe a referral to a pediatric psychologist or someone that might be able to really tease the situation apart and get it figured out. It's important to note that there are transient problems in kids, and like I said at the beginning of the conversation, some of those transient problems become long-term problems, but I would wait for a pattern that lasted more than a few weeks. I'd say a month or two before I got worried, because kids do go through some weird sleep, especially after they've been ill or if they're going through some kind of a weird growth spurt or developmental change. You'll see some sleep change patterns in kids that are short in duration. It's not anything to worry about, but the longer periods, I'd definitely look for some help on those.
And finally, for parents who may want to know a little more, are there any resources such as books or websites that you'd recommend for them to pursue?
Yeah, I really like a book called called Sleeping Through the Night. It's written by Jody Mindell, M-I-N-D-E-L-L, PhD. She has some other written material out there, too, and I think anything by her is going to be research-based and have some good recommendations. And in this particular book, Sleeping Through the Night, How Infants, Toddlers, and Their Parents Can Get a Good Night's Sleep, is written for parents. She has some other resources that are written for professionals, too. This one, I think, is a really nice. I was actually looking at it while we were talking. It has a nice graph, and it shows exactly how much sleep day and night children need each year of age. So I think it's a good kind of book to keep on hand and just reference when you're wondering.
Okay. Well, Dr. Palaha, thank you for your time today.
It was my pleasure.
Join us next time when Trent Codd interviews Dr. Daniel Willingham on the myth of learning styles on the Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Center of Western North Carolina podcast. For details, please visit behaviortherapist.com. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to next time.